Hi, and welcome to Watch Next, the podcast where we recommend what you should watch next. I'm Dr. Ruby Sanchez-Lozoya. Each episode, join me in a conversation with fascinating scholars and thinkers to explore world cinema in a way that feels warm, inviting, and completely jargon-free. Today, we sit down with Brittany Murray to discuss Queen. Brittany Murray is an assistant professor of French at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, where she specializes in 20th and 21st literature, cinema, and theory in French. She's the author of a forthcoming monograph entitled Time at the Brink of Impasse, French Culture in the 70s. Since we will be discussing the film in detail throughout the episode, consider this your spoiler reminder. And with that, let's begin.
Hi, and welcome to Watch Next. This is Dr. Brittany Murray.
And I am Dr. Ruby Sanchez-Lozoya. How are you, Brittany?
I am doing great today.
Great. So this is our first episode that we're recording. And basically what we're trying to do in this podcast is to talk about films and talk to scholars or thinkers or experts in their field about film that we think they would like and kind of start a conversation going about how we talk about cinema, but also what can we learn from them through to talking about films. We give our guests a questionnaire that tells us a little bit of what they like, what their preferences are in movies, and we try to match the film to the scholar, to the expert. Since we are starting this, we're going to do two episodes. One, Brittany recommends a film to me, and I recommend a film to Brittany. So I am a scholar of cinema of the Global South. I particularly work on Indian cinema. So the film I wanted to discuss was one from Indian. And Brittany, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Okay. So my beat is usually French and Francophone cinema. So this was really exciting to me because it was Ruby's recommendation. I saw something new that I had never seen before. And it's put me in a very good mood for this podcast because I'm just dying to talk about this film.
Okay. That sounds great. This is the time where we would introduce our guest. But Brittany Murray is the unrecognized inventor of the hot Cheeto. But she's also a fabulous scholar of French cinema in the Department of World Languages at University of Tennessee, Knoxville. And I'm very lucky to call her a good friend. So welcome, Brittany, to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. So this is really exciting because I get to talk with you, Ruby, and you're somebody who knows a lot about film. You're also a friend, and that really feeds into what we want to do here, which is talk about, watch movies, talk about them in a way that feels like we're in our living room, unselfconscious, without the jargon, just sharing a love, a mutual love of cinema.
And so the film that I recommend that is called Queen is Vikas Val, 2013 film. And Brittany, you said that you wanted to watch something that was more of a laugh than a cry. We also had questions on genre, not very much into ghosts. You are okay with musicals, very, very okay with nudity, which this film has none of.
But this film has a non-veg joke. So it does have a little spicy humor in there.
And I'm curious to see if what version you find and if it was censored at all, because I remember the first time I watched it, there were a couple of those non-veg elements to it that were censored that didn't make a lot of sense. Like the bra was censored, but not the hat in the porn shop.
That's true. Okay, so the bra was blurred out in mine. Mm-hmm. And especially during the scenes in Paris, there was some salty language in French that was kind of tactfully retranslated in the English subtitles because I had to watch the English subtitles.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So that was interesting.
Let's set the scene. How did you watch this film?
Okay, so I ended up watching this film streaming on my laptop with the headphones in, which, hear me out. Okay, so the music's really important to this film, but I felt like I was in this sort of intimate space watching this character go through her own individual journey, because that's kind of like the whole theme of the film is that she sets out on her own and travels on her own. So then I felt like I was in this kind of cocoon where I was going on this journey with the film.
And how do you deal with the length? It's only 2 hours and 20 minutes. So it's not too bad for Indian films, which tend to be around 3 hours long.
Okay. So, full confession. Uh-huh. I started the film a little bit late, but it worked out because, so it happens, it starts in Delhi, right? And then she goes to Paris.
Yeah.
So that then she takes off for Amsterdam, and that's where I did a pause, went to sleep, and then woke up, and then finished the journey to Amsterdam and back.
That's great, because that's actually the intermission point.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I intuited the intermission point.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And that's actually a weird thing nowadays, that you don't get to see the words intermission or interval. So you don't really know, which I would say is a huge loss. I'm a big fan of having intermission in films. I let people go to the bathroom, take a break, and then come back as God intended.
Oh, I wanted to ask you that because maybe this is naive, but I thought maybe that the version I was streaming would say intermission. But it played through, and I wanted to ask you about that. Okay. So if this were in the theater, there would have still been an intermission to let people take their comfort break. So I kind of intuited the intermission when I had this experience. And also because this is a very culinary film.
Yes.
So you need the break for snacks. Like you see her cook, you see all these different street foods. She's on her travels. It's a, you know, it makes a person snacky.
So let's get right into it. We think we talked about a little bit about the background of the film, but just to add a couple more things. The film was directed by Vikas Val and was released in 2013. It's a Hindi film. This is why Brittany mentioned that she watched it with English subtitles. And as a very quick plot summary that Brittany already kind of hinted at, it's a story that follows the character Rani. She's a 24-year-old homely girl who decides to go on her honeymoon after her fiancé calls off the wedding the day before the wedding. So she travels to Europe, and it's this journey of self-discovery, of finding joy again. So, Brittany, first reactions to the film.
Okay. Music, amazing. Dancing, amazing. This film had a special place in my heart because she's traveling. So there's a part where she goes to Paris. And so then I thought, oh, this is perfect for the podcast because it was Ruby's recommendation, but had a little French flair for me. What else? Super funny.
Uh-huh.
Like very funny. Okay. You snuck it in because there's also some slightly sad moments. I wouldn't say pouring tears, but you know, the single tear, the touching moments.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why I suggested the film, other than your preferences, it was because of that French connection, and we should talk more about it. It's also a flâneuse film, right? It's about a woman in the city, walking in the city, discovering the city. So I feel like it was really much up your alley about talking again, not on the French connection, only in terms of the city of Paris, but also this tradition in French cinema as well. And one scene that I really wanted to talk about is the music and the dancing sequence that you were talking about. Do you have or you remember like a favorite song or a favorite moment in the film?
Okay, so there's that one song that comes back more than often, more than once. Mm-hmm. And the first time is when she goes out in the bar in Paris, and then it comes back in Amsterdam. And it's about how when you take one sip, it's this huge scandal. Yeah.
Yes.
But that, like, the truth is in the bottom of the glass. Like, you can't hide anything once you get to the bottom of the glass. And I liked that song a lot.
This is actually one of the parts that I talked to in my class, because I think it's a huge moment in the film that marks, like, a before and after for Rani. And it's to me, it's such a fantastic breakup film. It's a pick yourself up kind of film. It's a feel-good film. It's a find yourself film, and very young too. So I really like recommending it to students to watch it. And so in the bar, we see her drinking for the first time, right? They have like pour alcohol in her mouth, and then she like that the beginning of her drinking. She's talking to strangers in Hindi. They don't understand, but like who cares? And she's drinking wine and kind of reflecting of all the things of how she has always been. She has always done what as she's told. She's been very good as a rule follower. She doesn't step out of line. She's good to her parents, good to her teachers. And starts talking to Vijayalakshmi of, you know, what? Why did Vijay leave me? I'm pretty sure he had sex when he was in London. Or why did this happen to me? I have done everything right. And then she thinks about her uncle, Gupta uncle, who says that he got cancer even though he never drank and he never smoked. So maybe he should have lived a little. And then at this moment is when we start hearing Hindi music. And she gets very excited because she finds a way of reconnecting to something that she knows. Hindi songs, Bollywood songs. And they're playing in the club. And I think one of my favorite moments is that she like starts feeling like, okay, she's wanting to dance. So she wants to get on the bar where all the girls are dancing. And she sees like there's a girl who's like removing her her clothes and like and making the like spinning motion. So she removes her sweater, but she's a sensible girl and puts her back in her bag. It was like, this is a good sweater. Like, I'm not going to throw it, right? So I like that Rani, it never betrays, like, the film never betrays who Rani is, right? She's not going to go wild, be a completely 180. She's just going to grow. And that's a moment that I really like in the film.
That's true that, like, also at the moment where she meets Vijay Lakshmi, it's kind of like her first friend that she makes when she's traveling. And they're completely different, and she's open to this friend. She sort of accepts her new friend on her own terms, but she also doesn't change who she is, mm-hmm. or, you know, try and like assimilate herself to this friend or become this friend. That's true. And that kind of the same thing happens again when she joins that hostel in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. It's like she meets all these people, that she meets them where they are, she embraces who they are, but she doesn't sort of try to change herself to fit in.
Right. And that I also, and we should talk about the ending of the film in a moment, because I think that is one of the nicest things of the takeaways, that even though she does change and grow throughout her journey there, is the solution, in a sense, that the film gives is not like completely change who you are. It's like, this was wrong, this is right. It's like, let's just give yourself more room to breathe. And we kind of see it in that bar scene when she's starting to dance. And I love the expressions of her. Like, it's an angry dance. It's enjoyable and she's having a lot of fun. But this really, the rebellion is coming through her facial expressions, especially because we come back from a flashback in which Rani's talking to Vijay, who's very upset with her for dancing in a wedding. And she says, all the girls were dancing. And it's like, I don't care about the other girls. I care what you are doing. And it's the moment when it dawns to her that the many ways that he has stunted herself and her growth and her enjoyment. I think it's an interesting and a very fascinating thing. I'm wondering what you think about this feminine act of rebellion through joy. Like, what do you think about this? Like, as a feminist stance, to feel joy, to embody joy, to perform joy.
Oh, that's interesting. I love how you put that. And now that I'm thinking about it that way, I'm like, well, it was kind of in her all along, because she had studied like culinary mm-hmm. arts when she was young, and she'd always been like passionate about food, and she works in this sweet shop. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like Vijay misinterpreted. He was like, oh, you're so sweet. It's like you're dipped in syrup.
Right.
But it could also be read as like a preview that she's somebody who sort of knows joy, who knows delight, and that she just becomes more herself. That's true.
And what I also like about the sequence is the two things that are happening in, one is in terms of the sound, and the one thing is in terms of the costuming and the hair and the makeup. Costuming in the film is fantastic, because she goes through wearing kurtas all the time and like very tied up clothes. To it's still, again, a moment that she doesn't completely change, but she starts like changing her style, kind of like venturing a little bit further, to the point that she goes to wear the very daring low plunge and sleeveless kurta, right? She doesn't take Vijay Lakshmi clothes. She doesn't become Vijay Lakshmi, but she is kind of like allowing herself to show more skin, to breathe a little bit more, to take more space, and her hair is doing this. She's always with her hair tied up. And in the moment that she starts dancing in the club, she's herself undoing her braid and letting her hair go wild.
Oh, that's true. That's true. And then, like, as the film goes on, she often wears her hair down or, like, up in a kind of a loose swinging ponytail. Mm-hmm. That is true. I really liked, there's one outfit that she wears that's kind of, it's like a white sweater. And it's over this dress that's really patterned with like kind of red flowers.
Yes.
And you can still see the pattern of the dress through the sweater.
The other thing happening with sound that I like is that it's a combination of the 1973 song Hangama, which is sung by Asha Bosley, which is a higher pitched voice, and the California Dreaming song of 1965 by the Mamas and Papas. So the remix itself is actually very interesting, that it is a cosmopolitan song and it's not a French song. So I'm wondering what you think about that, that why are we going to the 60s in America to and this fusion of 70s Bollywood and 60s American pop song? What you mentioned in the lyrics, right? That she says, which is echoing what's happening in the film, whenever somebody sees me do anything, they think it's going to be a scandal, and becomes a celebration song in the film.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. And okay, so now I'm thinking more about it as you're explaining the soundtrack, because it's also true that wherever she goes, like, she meets all these new people, she encounters all these new situations, but she's also never alone. Like, mm-hmm. she'll visit relatives, or she'll meet a friend who's like Vijayalakshmi has like been to India, or she'll like hear Bollywood music, or you know, people will dance. So that's really, that is true, that it's always like a blend of something that she's familiar with something new that she's encountering.
Mm.
Like, even when she's in Amsterdam, her friends like discover the video of her pre-wedding dance.
Yes.
So it's like there's always like a piece of her past or a piece of her that follows.
On that video, what do you think of that moment when everybody's leaving they're leaving their piece behind at the hostel, and Taka leaves a picture of his parents, and Rani leaves a picture of, well, not a picture, excuse me, her wedding card.
Oh, okay. She initially doesn't know this. Like, she doesn't know that her hostel mate has lost his parents. This is something that she becomes privy to this information as this friend group forms, mm-hmm. and as they open up. And then I remember that she had seen him, like, sort of kiss this photograph, mm-hmm. and put it under his bed before. And they're in this hostel where the walls are, like, papered with different things that people have left behind. Okay. I'm working my way up to this. Okay, so then the video happens. And do you read it like she's initially embarrassed or kind of shy that they found this, and that it's like this blast from the past?
Maybe my question is coming from having seen that scene where she's haunted by her past when the video resurfaces. And like we learn a lot about her and her friends in that sequence. We learn that she's still hurt, but also that she has found good people around her that are, like, not only Alexander sees, like, I'm able to read her change in demeanor, and then like says it's just through body language to his friends that, like, let's not, like, this is not funny for her, but that her friends have, like, this is this very close connection that happen in only can happen in hostels, right, and or traveling, which, as I'm talking about this, I think it is a very beautiful moment in the scene that Taka also understands this, basically a stranger, someone that he didn't know 5 days prior, and he still understands who she is and understands her pain and wants to cheer her up, right? And I think that's kind of a beautiful thing that the film is doing in terms of showing what the potential of travel is, that people see you not as who you were back home, but the person you're presenting yourself to be at that moment.
Oh, that's so true. It's almost because, like, once they perceive that she's shy or embarrassed or uncomfortable with the video, it's almost like, even the way that the actors are blocked and stuff, it's almost like they catch on to how she's feeling and surround her. And it's almost like their presence and their sort of this forming friendship and their warmth absorbs whatever regret she's feeling or embarrassment she's feeling. And it's almost like it reframes the video for her a little mm-hmm. bit. That is true.
And the way that I read the sequence when they leave, because you also have to leave, right? Part of the experience of the travel. So it's a way also thinking of this as a travel film is that you have to come back, right? And that the experience is ephemeral and sometimes it's short, sometimes it's long, because it's such a finite amount of time that it's a moment that allows for to break barriers in a sense and with yourself and how you present yourself to others. So it's an opportunity moment when you think of travel. And the ending that happens in that moment when they are about to leave because they have to move on, Taka leaves that pain. I mean, that's how I'm reading it. How are you reading it? I'm reading as he leaves the pain of losing his parents. Obviously, he's always going to mourn them. I think the grief is not gone. But I read it that he's taking one step to be better with his grief, because Rani echoes that by putting the wedding card. Is that this is something that is still painful, is still raw, but I feel like I can take the next step in mourning that life. I think it's a kind of mourning that is happening between those two characters.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Because there's a couple scenes where there's like almost something unspoken happens, like an understanding between the two of them. Like she gives him a hug at a certain point, and there's not like a ton of dialogue, but you can just tell that they've reached some understanding between the characters. Okay, this explains too, maybe the last rock concert that they all go to. So I should have known because it's a travel film, and travel is like you go and you come back. But I had gotten into this place where I was like, oh, this friendship, like, it's so, you know, it's so nice to see these four characters together. Like, Ronnie's grown so much. The other hostel mates have embraced her. I was like, maybe this will last forever. Maybe they'll always be together. And she goes to the rock concert. Like, she's told Vijay that he's just going to have to hold his horses, that she has her own life, that she has her priorities. She goes to the rock concert. And at this point, I'm like, yes, maybe this can last forever. Maybe this is just how things are now. And it's at the rock concert that she finds her friends, she meets them, and then, you know, they catch the hour and it's like, oh, you have to, like, you can't stay forever. It's like a rock concert. It's amazing and it's ephemeral. Mm-hmm. And you change and you grow. And then you have to keep going. So I guess now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, that scene totally makes sense in light of everything you've been talking about grief and moving on and keeping a part of you with you, even as you move through life and change. But I guess a little part of me just hoped they could be at that rock concert together forever.
Yeah. So why do you think the film ends back in India and not in the at the rock concert? Because that, I think that could have been a way ending the film, right? Just she goes to her friends. And like then, so it could end with she meeting the friends, or she could meet, they met the friends, but they have to go. And then she stays and has her awesome moment of hurrah and then cut to black. But no, we also have this almost like an epilogue when she goes back to India.
And she has to confront Vijay one last time too, mm-hmm. right? Like the convo in Amsterdam wasn't the end.
Right.
There has to be like a second moment. Yeah, that's a good question. Okay, so why does she have to go back? So why does she go back at the end of the film? Like, why is, you're saying it's like an epilogue.
Mm-hmm.
And also, why does she sort of have to have this conversation with Vijay more than once to really, like, put it to rest?
I think that I'm curious to hear what you say in terms of how other travel films end. Or the hero's journey films, and especially when the hero's journey is, you have a problem, you go to a third space, and then you come back. The travel film usually is that the traveler, there's something to be said with the traveler stays in the place, or the traveler comes back home. For me, it was important that she comes back home because that way we can see that the changes that happened to her in Paris and in Amsterdam are continuing back home, right? This is not a fantasy that stops once you return, but rather it's actually like a change completely. And it also allows us to see the life that would have been really if she had married Vijay, which is that her mother-in-law wanted her just to basically become her. And like she actually can, I think it's a moment where you actually do see Rani's growth other than the costuming again with the short sleeve kurta and the like low flowing hair. But she actually confronts her and says, oh, like you left us. Why didn't you tell us that you were going to Paris? And she's like, but why didn't you call me? All Rani would have never done that.
That's true. Yeah, okay, so I guess also, like, it's one thing, it's huge growth to be in Amsterdam and be like, listen, Vijay, like, I can't do everything on your schedule. I have my own life. I have a rock concert I'm going to. Mm-hmm. I have my own friends. Like, that's growth. But I see your point, too, that it's, like, yet another step to be back, like, back in India, back with her family, back in her own old life, and be like, I still can't march by somebody else's drum. I still can't follow somebody else's schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes. I have my own life and my own plans and my own journey to take.
In a more permanent matter that is not just, oh, later, but it's a never, right? I think it's the change from talk to you soon to never again, please. by giving back the ring.
That's true.
Did you wanted her to stay with Alexander?
Oh, okay. I kept seeing these glances, these stolen glances. Then she has a nickname for him. So I'm like, okay, the stolen glances, the nickname. Like, I was like, oh, is something going to happen between these two? But then I almost didn't want it to happen because, like, the whole, I felt like all the, like, the narrative thrust of the movie was that she was, like, finding her own way and finding her own direction. And then I also didn't want it. I also sort of didn't want them to get together because I loved the group of four from the hostel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, but the magic, it's like all four of them that make it magical.
Yeah. I think it would have been a very different film if it had just been the change of one good boyfriend against a bad boyfriend. I think the film was of Rani's growth as a woman rather than, oh, you just have to find the right man. Or in a sense, like you're saying of the friendship, yeah, like the you can have the relationship with men and they don't have to be romantic relationships. You can have really strong connections in platonic ways.
Okay. So then we have to talk about the restaurant in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Because it's amazing. Because like part of that scene is all about seeing all of her culinary skills be activated and see her. She also like stands up for her instincts about recipes. It sort of makes this whole thing come to life. And her friends help her with her stand. But yeah, then there's also this restaurant owner who's a little sus.
Yeah, he's twice her age. I don't fully get it. I don't get it. But do you know who Imran Hashmi is? So there's a moment when they have competed. She has won him over by her culinary prowess, which makes sense not because she's a woman and she knows how to cook, but she actually did study home science, right? And she has the business background with her dad, etc. So it's not just that, but. This is a weird, for me, it's a weird moment of national pride, how you have to represent the country outside of the country. And yes, you have done it through cuisine. And now you have to do in this very bizarre kissing competition against the Italians of all people, which is bizarre. But anyway, and then she invokes Imran Hashmi. And it's interesting because Imran Hashmi is an actor in Bollywood who's famous for his kissing scenes. And Bollywood is notorious for a long time not having kissing on screen. So we can see that shyness when she says lip-to-lip kiss. And one of my favorite lines when he says, yeah, what else, like knee-to-knee? And mostly because in Indian cinema, for a long time, I would say it's perhaps from the 2010s or so, we see less and less of this, you see no kissing on screen. You would see some kind of censorship of a flower and bees or two flowers with each other, or like they would go back around the tree, or the camera will fall down and you are meant to understand that in those in-betweens, there was a kiss or more than a kiss. And Imran Hashmi was that guy to not do any of that. 90s, 2000s, very passionate kisses. So she invokes Imran Hashmi that way. And the funny thing is, it was never actually banned. Like, it's not in the books, it's not in the law. But it was just something that was done for many, many years. And this is, I started my research on this in looking at, okay, what are the, who has done kissing on screen, etc. And the first kiss is from the 1920s. So it's very interesting how a romance has been shown on the Indian screen.
Wait, so when she says lip-to-lip kiss, really, is she also like doing a little wink to the camera and to the audience? Like, are we going to, you know, like, are we going to film this? Like, are we going to screen this?
Yeah, the audiences will understand that lip to lip is it's that thing, is that contact that you will not allow, in contrast to the very many examples of we have of kissing, but almost there. Like the neck is perfectly fine. The forehead is perfectly fine. Almost kissing the lips is perfectly fine. So I would say Indian cinema is the best thing for the slow burn and for teasing it out. And some scholars have said it's much more erotic this way because you're just expecting it to happen.
Oh, that's an interesting point. That goes really well too with like there are scenes like in Amsterdam, there are scenes where you think, you know, it might be like erotic and actually it turns into like scenes of like humor and friendship mm-hmm. or scenes of like bonding and connection. Like when she seeks out Roxanne.
Yes.
It's in the red light district, but actually her bond with Roxanne ends up being quite, you know, it's like a friend to friend kind of like, yeah, bonding moment. That's really interesting that there's like there's slow burns that are quite passionate without so much explicit lip-to-lip kissing. And then there are also sort of like feisty moments in Amsterdam or in the red light district that are actually end up being about humor and friendship. And yeah.
What I like about also that scene with Roxette is that Rani, I think she stays true to herself throughout the film. She's fairly conservative. She's like, this is such a difficult work that you're doing. But she's actually very respectful of Vijay Lakshmi and her. I mean, she's like, you dance beautifully. It's like she's able to recognize this. And it's not a conservative that is judging them at any moment. She wouldn't do it herself. And she does tell Vijay Lakshmi, maybe you should drink a little bit less. And maybe you should be more discerning. But it shows that this is a way of connecting with people and not necessarily who would be in your circles or would like or something that you would do yourself.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true. There's also like her grandmother from back home. There's like this ongoing joke where her grandmother is like, you know, seems like generally a very correct person, but sometimes her grandmother will like crack a joke that's like, you know, she's been around, like she wasn't born yesterday, like she's got a sense of humor and sort of welcomes people.
Yeah, I love the grandmother character. She's fantastic. She's a great grandmother. And I think it's one of those very subtle moments that the film is subversive, is that the way that you imagine, like I think grandmothers either get to be, because they're outside of certain ways of thinking of womanhood because of their age. They either are portrayed as being very, very conservative or completely the opposite, right? They are just completely wild because they're allowed to have that wildness because they're outside of the reproductive market. But also she has a wonderful father who's very concerned about her, gives her food when she is locked in, and understands that if he says no, she would follow what he says. But it's like, I need to trust her to be able to pick herself up.
And all the check-ins, they're always like so curious. Her family's always so curious and sort of open to what she's experiencing, the friends that she's met. She introduces Vijay Lakshmi to her family just virtually through the screen, through the video call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that really resonates with what you're saying about the father that he's. Like so many times he's worried about her, but, you know, he's so open to whatever she's experiencing and hearing about, you know, what she's seen abroad, who she's met.
That this is a moment where you can see that this is not a completely fantasy film, but you see the maybe insidious patriarchy that happens. And that the mom, for example, who's also very wonderful, tells Rani to bring her younger brother as a chaperone, right? What is he going to do? But like he was there during their first date, and then he was there when he breaks up with her, and he was there. Oh, no, he takes her to the airport, and he says, oh, like, why are you going by yourself? Take Chintu with you. You know, because you should have a male companion, right? So, like, the film always reminds you of, like, yeah, it's not just BJ who's the problem here.
Oh, yeah, and, okay, so it came out in 2013,
mm-hmm.
2014. Okay, because so the little brother is the chaperone, but also in the film, we're aware that there's always screens. Like, we're always kind of being watched on screens. Like, there's always the evidence of the video call, or at the end, there's like the during the closing credits, it's like it's her Facebook timeline. So there's always that awareness of kind of like how, like, it's beginning to think about like social media and extra screens and digital awareness about like how you'll come off. You're almost like sort of being chaperoned by these other screens, like how you'll come off. It comes up, you know, when her video replays on the YouTube, like, okay, people have access to videos of you.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting, because it is actually very ahead of its time of this way that we're living for the image, and we're also being surrounded by images. We're living for the camera and always surrounded by cameras. Which is very interesting.
Can I ask you, what's the fandom like for this movie? Like you said, you love to show it to young people, and it definitely seems like it could be like sort of like an anthem and a the sort of movie that women would come back to, because it's like the story of, you know, I don't know, being young and being independent. Tell me who else, like, what's the fandom like for this movie?
I think it was very, very, very well received when it came out, precisely because of the things that you mentioned. In the 10 years that the film was released, like after, like in the things that have happened since its release, the actress is now a member of politics, very traditional, very conservative. And the director, he was accused of sexual harassment. So it's interesting to see this film almost as a bubble of its time. And I think it allows for a very good conversation regarding separating art and the artist, if it's something you can ever do. So because Val, who is the director of the film, his scandal came around the Me Too moment in India. And because of the allegations against him, one of the producer companies, Phantom Films, was broken apart. But he himself has nonetheless been accepted in the Bollywood industry. He had a film years later with one of the biggest stars, Hrithik Roshan, made tons of money. So while some people were held accountable during the Me Too movement in India, he was definitely not one of them. So it's weird to think that the people behind this film are very different from who was being portrayed in the film. And we can have in the show notes more works that talk about this. And I've written about this, I think it's in my book, or in one of the articles that I have, about the question of what do you do with the work of Monstrous Men? And this is coming from a Paris Review who asked this very same question. There's a book that just came out too on this question and on cancel culture, which I haven't read, but I'm excited to read. And what I argue in regards to this is that, A, you kind of need to and you have to, especially because the work of women is very precarious. So when it is being mediated by the reputation of a director, for example, then that work is going to be gone. And in this case, it can be the character itself that would be gone, that it was such a momentous occasion for women. Like, it did have that fandom. It was very inspiring. But it's also written by the screenplay is by a woman. So her work would also be lost if we forget about this film because of what Picasso Val did.
Wow, this is such an interesting case. Such a reminder, too, that, you know, like, there's a story that takes place on screen, and then there's, like, this longer story about the production process and the reception history, and that, yeah, it's really complicated the way that those two things go together. That's so true that, yeah, screen representation is important, like, if women are triumphing on screen, or, like, you said it's so revolutionary to see joy, like someone sort of go out and explore through joy. So that, I hear you saying, like, that in and of itself is important to capture that moment on screen. And then also it's important, this like longer story of how people were interacting behind the scenes. Man, how must the audience have felt too as this information came out? It was like information they didn't know that sort of changed the way that they understood this film.
When all this started coming up, it really felt like a betrayal, and a betrayal to the character. The way that I approach it is, when we are making these binary choices, which are not real choices, between monsters and men. What I argue is that it's very easy to put yourself in the position that you would know a monster when you see one, right? So you're taking away the humanity of someone, but also when you imagine the world divided between monsters and not monsters, then when you know someone and they're not acting like an imagined monster, then you might not believe somebody when they tell you this, or you might not recognize it because they're nice to me, right? And it's also, it keeps you in a very comfortable position where you could never possibly behave like this. So I think what is important about when thinking about this film and other films like this in their context, as you are discussing, is to make the difficult work of not wanting to have an easy solution of either or, but rather actually sit in the uncomfortable place of being able to understand the film in its context. Do not give it a pass and quote unquote of like, oh, it's just a movie, but rather understand it for what it is, what signifies in its cultural time, and what it does for you as an audience. And if it makes it imperfect in your mind, then let it be imperfect in your mind and be able to discuss the film in this larger context.
That makes sense. And it also kind of, like what you're talking about too, goes into like, who do we think has ownership over the film? Because mm-hmm. you were saying like we might think, oh, it's the director, or oh, it's the lead actress. But if, you know, as you were talking, I was like, oh, but there's also like the costume directors. You were saying that the costume is such an important part of the story. Mm-hmm. There's also like the set designers, because the setting is really important. That there's the people who mixed the sound and did the soundtrack. We said that was really important. And it's a good reminder that not everybody, that film is this collaborative medium. And it's hard to tell how people were interacting on set, or the sort of the different positions that all these different artists might be coming from. So then what do we make of this artifact that's kind of the combination of all their efforts? That is really interesting.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought this up, because that is true, especially with cinema, that is such a collaborative work. That it's easy to think about it as the work of one person, because usually the star or the director becomes the person, when it's rarely the case. Even though you have that the whole point of the director is the driving force, etc., we have to remember of like this, it's a work of a team, but also once it's out, it also belongs to the audience.
Yeah, that's true too. Like, and you're talking about the way that this has been sort of reconsidered and remembered over time, that people might have received it one way when it first came out, and then as new information comes to light, it's up to the audience to say, how do they sort of internalize that information, and how do they reframe the film as it goes?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, as a scholar of Francophone cinema, what it was like to see Paris through this lens, and how does it compare perhaps to other films about Paris, or of like the newcomer comes to town?
It was really interesting. It was interesting to see Paris in this different way. When you said the word flâneur, I was like, oh, I love that. I love that way of framing this film. And I was thinking, we've talked too about all the, like the tradition too of specifically women sort of walking through a city, women walking through Paris. At one point we talked about Cleo from 5 to 7 by Agnès Varda. Also the story of a woman walking through Paris, sort of processing her life and thinking through her independence. So that was really interesting. I don't always know if films always quite grasp how foreboding Paris can be to newcomers and to outsiders. Maybe you wouldn't notice that if you're just like, you know, very comfortable, longtime resident of Paris. Mm. I thought that this film did a good job, even though it's a very light celebratory film. It does mark these moments where maybe she feels a little bit sort of intimidated or othered. There's an actual act of aggression, like when the person attacks her and tries to steal her purse and she fights it off. So there are these moments where it actually does register what Paris can feel like to women, to people who are traveling, to people who are traveling from the global south, who feel maybe like, who kind of feel a little bit more of how this can be a bit daunting.
Mm. I like this what you said too, of this recognition of there's always the Paris of the mind and the Paris of the film, and then the Paris, even that is not quote unquote real, not even the local Paris, but it's also the lived experience of being in Paris for the first time, or as a newcomer, or as an outsider, right? And that it is a little bit of that struggle. And I think people make a huge difference. It was interesting to see how cosmopolitan it does look by her group of friends.
That's true. That's true. And also, like, that every, you know, in both Paris and Amsterdam, it's cosmopolitan, and there always are, like, even if it feels daunting, there are always these points of familiarity or points of connection that already are there. You know, there's some parts that are movie magic, like,
yes,
maybe not everybody, you know, like, has a choreographed dance number when they arrive in Paris. So that part is kind of, is sort of magical, but it also does kind of show what could be difficult about women traveling alone in a city. That balance is really interesting there.
Yeah, and I mean, I just feel like it is nonetheless a good film to show if you are hesitant of traveling alone as a woman in the city, that it is going to be hard, but it is very, very rewarding. And it does get, I mean, I don't want to say it does get better, but it does get better. I feel like it's not a film, it's a film that understands that there are this gender politics of traveling by yourself, but that this, I mean, actually, that's a very good question. What is it in the film that allows, what is it in the film that allows Rani to feel more comfortable being alone in the city? And I think it's Vijayalakshmi, right? It's female friendship that allows her to feel more, she's the Virgil in this scenario.
Oh, I love that Vijayalakshmi is her her Virgil, her sage, mm-hmm. her wise guide. Oh, that's true. I was also thinking about, like, the cooking scenes, like when she gets to Amsterdam, it's not easy immediately. Like, she encounters some of that, Europeans saying, like, oh, they're not comfortable with spicy food. Oh, they don't understand. But then she's, like, drawing on her talent. She's drawing on her strengths. She's drawing on, you know, this initial, like, her education, this initial sort of dream, this recognition that she had that she's a great chef, that she's been to culinary school, that this is really an area of strength and talent. And she is able to sort of make her recipes and share those. It's not easy at first, but she's able to do that, I guess, with her guide and by drawing on her own interests and strengths. Yeah.
Well, Brittany, it's been a lot of fun talking to you about Queen. I guess it's time now to do your rapid fire. So we want to end each episode with a rapid fire to our guest, in which we ask them questions about cinema, just to bring it all together. Let me find those questions. Brittany, are you ready for your rapid fire questions?
Yes, hit me with them. I'm ready.
Okay, I'm not. Okay, there you go. Number one, favorite movie snack?
Oh, I'm a classicist, popcorn.
Okay, movie theater or streaming?
Oh, okay, this is so hard. They're both great. Okay. I'm going to say movie theater for like a big popcorn film. Like, give me a movie theater for action sequences, for big costumes, for big dance numbers, for musicals, for cool special effects. I'm going to say give me a streaming if we're telling like a small story. Then we're watching it, we're snuggled up. We can pause on our device to refill the popcorn bucket.
Okay.
That's where I fall on that one.
Trailers or no spoilers?
Oh, trailers. Okay. Trailers. Yeah.
Movie you would like to see again for the first time?
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Listeners, there is a movie called Fallen. It stars Denzel Washington, and it's a scary movie. I saw this too young. I am still afraid of it. So I wish that I could rewatch it for the first time as an adult so that I would be ready, so that I'd be ready for the jump scares and that I wouldn't be so scared of this movie.
Okay. I'll ask this anyway. Movie you watch way too young.
Oh. Okay.
What?
I double answered. Okay. Also, there's a movie version of Witches.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I watched this too young, and I was so afraid of that film.
I remember that film. One film that is required watching, or in like that you always assign it in your syllabus, or that you think everybody should watch.
Oh, and yes, Father, the Gleaners and I. It's so sweet.
Great. Thank you so much, Brittany, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Watch Next. A huge thanks to our guests for joining us today, and to everyone at Lates and at UT Austin's College of Liberal Arts and the Department of Asian Studies for making this show possible. Make sure to subscribe so you never miss a conversation. Leave us a rating or a review to help other listeners discover the filmmakers and scholars we feature. New episodes drop every 2 weeks. Listen to Watch Next wherever you get your podcasts.